I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello and welcome to the Curzon Film Podcast. I'm Jake Cunningham, and this week I am joined by Diego Aparicio from the UCL Film Society.
Hello.
Hello, Diego. And our regular contributor, Rena Musumeci.
Good morning.
Our very own fantastic woman, to talk about Sebastian Lelio's A Fantastic Woman, which
this
is...
This has to stop.
Sorry.
Shall we redo it?
I thought that was good.
He can't resist
puns. Can't just guffaw.
It's actually Berlin Film Festival happening at the moment across the continent, and it would have been a year ago that Sebastian Lelio's A Fantastic Woman premiered, and it began this journey that has led it to an Oscar nomination. And this is a really wonderful film that we're really excited to bring to the UK. And Rena, I wonder if you could just tell us a bit about this film.
So very quickly, the film A Fantastic Woman is about a truly fantastic woman. The titular character is Marina, who is a part-time waitress and part-time singer. And she's in a very happy relationship with her partner, Orlando. Orlando dies at the very beginning of the film, and Marina is left alone to face prejudice. Marina is a trans woman. And the film is very much not a transition story, but it's very much about the aftermath of what happens in her life once her partner dies.
It's a really beautiful film. It's really stunningly shot, and it kind of weaves between genres in a quite magical way. And we're really excited to actually bring you an interview with the director, Sebastian Lelio, that Sam has done. So we will be bringing that to you a bit later on in the show. But for now, let's just get our initial impressions, because I saw this film a long time ago in the film world, I suppose. And it was, 5 months ago at
October.
At the London Film Festival. Diego, you and I, we found out this morning we were at the same screening that had a post-film conversation with the film's writer. And I think both of you have been lucky enough to watch the film again, something I haven't been able to do yet. And I wonder if you could both just tell us about how you initially reacted to this film, what your first thoughts were.
Yeah, so I think the first time I went in to see the film, I didn't really know what to expect. I hadn't seen Lelio's previous work, so I was, you know, not sure what the feeling would be like. I just knew that it was about a transgender woman. And it's interesting because the vibe the film kind of gives off isn't really about, you know, this woman being transgender, but it's about her dealing with grief and her loss. Her lover dies at the very beginning, as Irene said. And I think the second time I was more able to sort of focus on the visuals more. I took in the music a lot more the second time.
I often find that your second viewing is like your craft viewing, that you're able to view it as a piece of filmmaking, and the first time you're viewing it as a piece of storytelling.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, was it Hitchcock who said, the first time you really watch a film is actually the second time you watch a film? Maybe I've been misinformed.
There's something about being able to kind of relax with it and knowing that you know where the journey is going to go, and you're free to appreciate it a lot more. I suppose I tend to watch films in a slightly different way because I have a lot of films under my belt by now. So to me, it's that complete package that always hits me the first time around. And sometimes I miss kind of plot details and I really get absorbed into the mise-en-scene in particular. I'm very susceptible to. And in this film, there's just such a wonderful... There are so many echoes of so many different filmmakers that I absolutely adore. And so it was this that kind of impressed me the first time around. The second time around, it was the construction of all the different parts that really amazed me. Because it's a film that really takes you on this emotional journey, much as every trailer in the world would like to surmise that every film does. But with this one, you're really with this character for such a long time. You know, over the 90 minutes of the film, which is a very kind of economical time to tell a story, she truly goes places. And I found that absolutely extraordinary. I watched her acting a lot more in the second viewing.
Absolutely.
And I thought it was just such a fantastic performance. There is so much happening in her face and the way she uses her eyes and her voice throughout the film is truly, you know, one of the greats. Mm. I think it's a great shame that Daniela Vega wasn't nominated for this performance because it's really impressive. And sometimes we've had in the past actors being nominated for playing transgender characters who are really very much doing that kind of put on big acting kind of thing. And here you have someone who is possibly living through some of the emotional turmoil that this character experiences, although it's very much not her story. She's been very clear about this in her interviews.
But it is very personal in many ways, isn't it?
Yeah, and the journey of how she came to be involved in the film is really interesting as well.
Yeah, this came up at the writers' Q&A that we both went to, and you've written a little bit, a fantastic piece for the UCL film blog, and I wonder, Diego, you could tell us about that context of how this film came to be and Daniela Vega's involvement in it.
Yeah, absolutely. So I was surprised to hear both from the screenwriter and later the director that actually the film wasn't going to be about a transgender woman at all. So they started playing with this idea about a woman losing her partner. And then I think it was Sebastian Lelio who thought, maybe there's something more we can tell. Maybe there's something really moving about a transgender woman being in that position and sort of being suspected or accused of having done something wrong. Further down the line, they kind of thought, if we're considering doing it with a transgender woman in the lead, maybe we should go and meet some transgender women in Santiago. And everyone was basically just telling them, you should meet Daniela. And she has an amazing voice, amazing sort of acting experience, and they kind of got to meet her and talk to her, and that's when they knew that actually her contribution as a consultant to the project would be very valuable, and then they realized we need her in the lead role.
Yeah, it's a really lovely story, and I think she's obviously proven her talent in her own country, and the fact that we're able to see it around the world now and she's getting that recognition, maybe not as much recognition as we all would like to see, but the fact that this film is going around the world, that people are going to be kind of caught up in her, because she's completely hypnotic in it, and she's got so much charisma, because there are these little moments where you get a sense of her stage presence, which we will delve into a bit later into the show, but she's just magnetic throughout.
There's also, as a kind of wider cultural point that I think is important to talk about, she will be the first transgender woman to present an Oscar on a come Oscar ceremony. And this is quite amazing. It's also the first time a transgender man has ever been nominated. So Jans Ford is nominated for Best Documentary, I think, for Strong Island, which is a really interesting film currently on Netflix. It's not a documentary about transgender issues really at all, but it's a very personal story about her brother who was murdered by a white, either policeman or just a white man. And it's very much about race in America. So, I mean, while the Oscars are a really huge piece of fluff and glitter, these are cultural milestones which are significant and important to acknowledge. There's been also a lot of films in which the representation of transgender characters has indeed featured transgender performers and actors. I can think of Tangerine recently, which was a really great one. And of course, the work of Pedro Almodovar is significant to be mentioned here. He cast Antonia San Juan in All About My Mother. She's a transgender actor. She plays a transgender role there. But I feel like I've always watched transgender performers play sex workers or kind of smaller parts. Mm-hmm. Or I've watched transgender actors work in stories about transition. And to me, this film really tries to do something else and kind of removes a lot of those barriers and kind of really works to not just normalize things, but to show what a depth and richness of stories there are out there. Mm.
So we will pass over now to Sebastian Lelio, the director of the film, who recently sat down with our regular host, Sam Howlett, to talk about the film in a bit more detail.
Delighted to welcome Sebastian Lelio to the Curzon podcast.
Thank Hello. You.
Hi. So we're here to talk about the Oscar-nominated Fantastic Woman. First of all, congratulations on
Thank
the nomination.
You. Thanks so much.
Where were you when you found out that you'd been nominated?
I was in Chile I was with my producers. It was like 10:30 a.m. We were drinking coffee and very nervous. and then suddenly that day became a great day.
Yeah. Did you watch the nominations live? Or?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah?
Oh, yeah.
Great, excellent.
That's what we were doing.
Yeah, oh, yeah. Sure. Okay, great. And will you be going to the Oscars?
Oh, of course, yeah. We'll be there.
Brilliant. Okay, so let's go back a bit then. Could you tell us a bit about, you know, where this story came from and how your journey with this film began?
Well, at the beginning, we were playing around with the question, you know, what would happen if the person you love dies in your arms? And that's the worst place for that person to die because you are the unwanted.
Yeah.
And then due to the script writing work, the idea of this story happening to a transgender woman appeared.
Right.
And that was like a milestone in the process. And it sounded moving, exciting, dangerous. And then I felt the need to meet some transgender woman. I live in Berlin, so I was a bit detached of what was happening in Santiago, my city. So we met two or three, not looking for an actress yet, but only looking for... I was trying to understand if I wanted to make the film back then. And then we met Daniela Vega, who is the actress.
Yeah.
He ended up being the main actress. And she agreed to become like a consultant. Mm-hmm. And so she was like a friend of the project during a year.
Right.
And she was sharing with us what being a transgender woman in Chile meant. And then I realized that I wanted to make the film, that I was not going to make it without a transgender actress. And later on, that I wanted her to be Marina, to be the main character.
Okay.
So that's how it happened.
Yeah.
It was very, very organic.
Yeah. Have you ever had a script change that dramatically before, like completely?
Yes, but in a different way. I think in this case, it was more dramatic because after Daniela accepted to play the main role, I knew that she was going to bring something that was going to add a dimension to the film that was going to make it very unique.
Yeah.
You know, because the film plays with different genres and tonalities.
Yeah.
And it's like fiction.
Right.
You know, it's like it's not biographical, it's not necessarily realism. It's kind of like something different than that, and it's a thriller that starts like a romantic film that becomes then a ghost story, that is a funeral film, and then it's a character study and you know, and has moments of fantasy.
So
I think that somehow comes from my relationship with Daniela. You know, because I was trying to make a film that was as complex as its main subject of study.
Yeah. Was there any sort of trepidation from your part about writing a film as a cisgender man from the perspective of a transgender woman?
I mean, I think that distance,
yeah,
is precisely what made everything more exciting to me, because because I am not an expert.
Yeah,
it's not my world. So so it was a great opportunity to, you know, to learn.
Yeah,
to get rid of my ignorance, to expand my understanding of what identity can be, or to think about these subjects. You know, like what are there illegitimate people?
Yeah,
or can a love like that be illegitimate?
Yeah, sure.
You know, so in a certain way, you make a film to arrive to a new place as a person.
Yeah.
Okay. And in that sense, you know, not being part of the community,
yeah,
is precisely what allows what I just said to happen.
Yeah, okay. And so you said you use Daniela as this kind of, you know, point of as an advisor on the film. What other research methods did you use? Because there are moments in the film, like when Daniela goes to the police station, that seem very, very real and very specific to a transgender person. Did that stuff like that, the sort of the institutional way she's treated, did that come from Daniela, or were there other avenues you explored?
No, I mean, the film is not biographical in any way.
Yeah.
I mean, there's no scene that is coming from an experience that Daniela has had. But it's just kind of like a general feeling that she, I don't know, transmitted to the script, all these microaggressions and all these ways in which the character is treated. I think all of that is coming out of our conversations, you know, of what, you know, being a transgender woman has meant for Daniela in Chile. But then everything is fictional, and and of course the institutional procedures, we did research how they work, and we apply that to this situation. So everything that happens could happen. Like that.
Okay. So it's been nearly a year since you played at Berlin. So it's been a lot of time for loads of people to see the film. Can you tell us a bit about the reaction from the transgender community that you've had from the film?
Well, I have the impression that that they have valued immensely the fact that the main character is interpreted by a transgender actress.
Yeah,
I think that changed the whole game, so to say. I cannot speak for them, but that's my feeling after showing it in so many countries and to so many people. We have felt a lot of gratefulness and appreciation, and not only, and that's the beauty of it, not only coming from the, I don't know, LGBT community, but from different kinds of spectators.
Okay.
So it's been a nice journey.
So then looking back over some of the films you've made recently, I mean, Gloria, Fantastic Woman, and then Disobedience, which comes out here later in the year.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they're all films focused on female protagonists in situations that we don't always see on screen.
Mm.
I mean, some people can see this as a kind of sort of unofficial trilogy for you. I mean, whether consciously or unconsciously.
Unconsciously.
Yeah.
Completely unconsciously.
Could you talk a bit about then why it is these kinds of characters that you focus on and what interests you about them?
Well, the thing is that it's funny because you connect the dots only when you look backwards.
Yeah.
You know, and honestly, I have been blindly following my intuitions. And what moves me, and there has been something about each of these stories that has been really, really touching to me. Like exciting and touching. And when I stumble with something like that, I just go for it, you know?
Yeah.
And then I intellectualize. But first of all, it's like, I don't know, it's like those people that are looking for water with wooden sticks.
Yeah, yeah.
And they're like, sometimes they stop and they say, here,
yeah.
You have to dig here because there's something here. It's kind of like the same feeling, like with Gloria, you know, the story about an older woman that claims her right to keep being alive with a fantastic woman, dedicating a film to a character that should not deserve one, so to say.
Yeah.
And then in Disobedience as well, you know, serving this two women that are somehow in their own way on the fringes of society. In the three cases, the driven force has been very similar. It's pure excitement and attaching, moving element.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's hard for me to intellectualize it. I mean, I can do it, but I feel like I'm putting words into something that is more of an intuition.
Yeah. Okay. Mm. I know from speaking to other people that have seen Fantastic Woman, one of the scenes that seems to me to be the most talked about is the dance sequence.
Oh, yeah.
And you mentioned earlier, actually, to me, that the film kind of goes across different genres. Mm. And that's very much this kind of, you know, it was a musical, like a music video.
Yeah.
Can you talk about where that idea came from and the process of filming that? Because it's so different from the rest of the film.
Yeah, well, at some point, you know, this idea of doing a transgenre film about a transgender character appeared, and that was a super important moment in the process because it was like, oh, so this device, which is the film, can contain so many tonalities and so many, it can flirt with different traditions, you know? So again, identity in flux, you know?
Sure, yeah.
And I don't know, I remember feeling that the nightclub sequence needed something more. And then I connected that to Babsy Berkeley's films. Yeah. And I was like, maybe we could, you know, really gamble everything and see if we can suddenly be inside her head and present, so to say, the best version of the character, even though it's not really happening.
Sure, yeah.
You know, so it was great fun to do it. And I'm very surprised to witness how much people like that sequence. Yeah.
Yeah, sure.
It's incredible.
So after Disobedience, then your next project is this a US remake of Gloria?
Yeah.
And
I did that already.
You've done it already?
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. I shot it.
Yeah, I was curious about whether this was it came from you. Is your idea to remake Gloria, or were you approached by someone else?
It's a combination.
Combination, okay.
It's a combination,
because, you know, you're not the first director to remake your own film, of course. It's happening. Hitchcock did it, and
I know.
Haneke's done it. But I've always wondered if there's a feeling of, you know, either I can do better. There's that feeling of, I've done this, but I know I can make it better. Or is there more something like, if this is going to be remade, I want to make sure I'm the one to do it. Yeah. Was it either of those things?
No, it was more, okay, a great admiration for Julianne Moore, first of all, and then the feeling of there might be a way to find a new vehicle for whatever is universal in this story. And then the luxury of having the opportunity to revisit your own materials and give them a new life.
Yeah.
You know?
Okay.
So I take it like a Goldberg variation.
Excellent. Sebastian Lillo, thank you so much.
Thank you.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
And we're back. So thanks to Sebastian for joining us on the show there. We left the conversation briefly talking a bit about Oscars and that kind of thing. Irene, you said that this can be a bit of fluff and glitter. A film like this is the kind of film that we love to see nominated and really I want to see win because it's giving it the chance to find an audience.
Absolutely.
And that's what these awards should be. Yeah. And maybe not, like, maybe there are some other awards that might have happened fairly recently in Britain that are maybe awarding films that don't need publicity and they should be awarding films that do. And this is the kind of platform that A Fantastic Woman could really gain from.
I completely agree. Yeah. You know, having said that, it is up against some tough competition with Loveless and maybe The Square. Although I do hear it is, you know, at the top of people's lists. So, you know, fingers crossed.
Yeah.
I think even a nomination, though, is great, and it's already giving it the attention it deserves.
Yeah. All right. So let's get a bit more stuck into the film now. And so it begins, we have maybe the opening 5 to 10 minutes is the only section of the film that we don't really see from her point of view. This is taken from Orlando. And I think that's going to, I know for me, because this was a festival screening, I didn't read too much into it. So that was a lovely little switch for me as to where I thought the film was going to be going.
As you know, I'm obsessed with opening scenes in films. I always think that just, you know, the first thing that you're presented with is the most significant thing to set the tone. And here we're presented with the image of a waterfall. There's a lot of water and steam and kind of vapors, and you don't quite know where you are. And then the titles appear in this beautiful sort of very subtle kind of quite ethereal way, and the title says A Fantastic Woman, and the first thing we look at after that is the body of a man.
Yes.
So there's an interesting clash there. I wanted to talk about these waterfalls in quite some detail. Did you recognize where these waterfalls are or what they are?
In the first few minutes of the film, they were a complete enigma to me, as is Marina for pretty much the entire film. But it's only later on, when the suspense sort of builds up around these falls, that you find out that Orlando has this sort of getaway trip planned for Marina's birthday, and he was actually meant to give her, he got them tickets to the Iguazu Falls, and that kind of makes you go, oh, that's what they were. Okay.
Yeah. So the falls become this kind of really symbolic thing because the trip never happens.
Yes.
Orlando has booked his tickets, but on the day of the birthday, we find out that he has completely lost them. He doesn't know where they are. So he gives Marina a card that says, this is valid for a trip. I actually bought the tickets. I'm sorry. I've completely forgotten. I can't find them, but I will. And we'll go there in 10 days' time. And of course, he dies. So the trip never happens. It's kind of this promised land or this place that's going to happen, which reminded me rather of Happy
Haneke.
Together.
Oh,
no.
Right.
Look at that. So if anyone familiar with Happy Together, which is one of Wong Kar-wai's great, great films, which is a love story between two men who are from Hong Kong and living in Argentina. The reason why the guys are in Argentina is that they own a lampshade, which has an image of the Iguazu waterfalls on it. And their big thing throughout the film is that they want to go and visit the waterfalls. There is always in Wong Kar-wai films this idea that there are these magical places in the world where you can kind of take your sorrows or take your undisclosed love or take your desires, speak them out into nature or into a secret place, and they will be kept there and you'll be guarded and something will happen. You know, something extremely transformative will happen to you. You'll be liberated or it will come through, come true. And in Happy Together, they keep trying to go to these waterfalls. The film opens with them driving there. They have this massive row and they end up not going. And of course, their relationship is incredibly complicated. It's very loving, but also abusive. It becomes very difficult. And this image of the waterfalls that they never get to continues to appear throughout the film. And by the end, there is some resolution in terms of where the main character ends up. So for me, you know, just watching these waterfalls and then thinking, oh, are we, where are we? You know, I was thinking, it's obviously Latin America. Is it the same waterfalls? And so suddenly, for me, the film was really in conversation with Wong Kar-wai from the very beginning. But I'm fascinated to hear your Haneke reference.
Right. I guess mine is a little bit less direct than that. I think what made me think of Haneke in the film was that scene in the car wash.
Oh, this
really claustrophobic scene where Marina is just alone and she sees Orlando's ghost. You know, it's one of the many times she does. But that sort of scene was just screaming The Seventh Continent to me, because I'd only recently watched The Seventh Continent. And this is where the viewer becomes part of, you know, the experience, right? You fill in the story with your own gaps. You see things that, you know, other people might not. But the sort of connection is also to that beach, that Australian beach in The Seventh Continent, which is their promised land. So this family's promise for something better. So a getaway trip, if you like, from reality. And
I don't, like, you know that thing where you hear a word for the first time and then you suddenly start hearing it everywhere?
Yeah, it's called the Bader-Meinhof effect.
Yes. So I've been having that with kind of queer stories and bodies of water. And I don't know whether it's because we talked about this with Call Me By Your Name, and I recently watched Beach Rats as well. And
like, interesting point.
Yeah, there's a number of things that keep cropping up, and even like waterfalls in particular, going back to Call Me By Your Name, which is in fact a dam and not a waterfall. But I'm having that Bader-Meinhof effect, but with exactly this.
It's a symbol of fluidity, isn't it? So I guess the film is very much about, you know, gender fluidity, but also, as you mentioned, genre fluidity. And I think that was one of the things that Lelio was very interested to explore after deciding that, you know, the lead character would be a transgender woman. So he deliberately tried to give the film a diverse range of feelings throughout. So you've got the romantic side of it. You've got, you know, a little bit of a thriller, a mystery, a character study.
An MGM musical.
Absolutely. but yeah, and also fantasy. And you don't expect to see all these things together necessarily, but it's just there, you know, the light, the neon lights. It's such a, I don't know, to me it felt very Lynchian as I was watching it. And it all seems to be sort of part of a dream a lot of the time.
Yeah, well, you spoke about there's a ghost, which we kind of dropped into this way. And all the while we've been talking about this as a kind of social commentary realist film, and they say, oh, and there's a ghost. of course there is. But that's what the film does. It drops in these little magical realism moments. And it's weird because you kind of see these promo photos of the film where that looks like a dance scene. And then you get dropped into the film and you're thinking, where is this going to happen?
but it does.
But yeah, they do. And these little moments are really, really wonderful. And you do have that ghost, and you've got Marina having to literally like battle against the wind to like an almost comic effect. And she is a singer, and we see her at the start singing in a club. It's quite a low-key, smoky setting, and it's very cool and very jazzy. And then she'll just drop into these fantastic choreographed cheerleader.
I mean, this is something that the Latin American culture really is a specialist in, you know, in capturing the kind of thin line between social realism and magic realism, in the sense that I think Latin American storytellers have a real fluidity in terms of how they see moments of great expressionism and moments of great political commentary, which is absolutely, by the way, throughout this film present. There's a lot of stuff about the police and how the police treat transgender people, the rights of transgender people, but also just this kind of society which has become incredibly bourgeois in a very rapid period of time. Something that we were discussing about Loveless, for example. Chile as a country has this very, very troubled history, lived under incredibly strict dictatorship under Pinochet for a long time. and the after effects of a very militarized, very macho culture are still very present. And so the men in this film, with the exception of Orlando, are really...
And Gabo, I think.
And
his
Gabo,
brother.
Yeah, although he's quite a... quite an interesting character. I think there's a whole series of characters in the film who mean well and yet
they're restricted
don't get
by
it.
Society's yes. overall sort of
it's,
yeah
I think that's
pressures.
Where the real struggle of the film happens. There's the police woman who comes
yes.
in and
yeah she means well as well but
she
then,
means well but then carries out something yes, that is yes. incredibly invasive and
yes.
almost like a sort of violation of Marina's body by
absolutely.
Forcing her to have an examination to check that there wasn't an act of violence perpetrated on her.
Hmm.
And at that point, why doesn't she believe the woman that is in front of her? She's saying, we were in a consensual relationship, we were happy, and the guy just died. Something that happens very early on in the film is when Orlando feels unwell, he collapses and falls down the stairs. As a result, his body has bruises on it. And the police take this immediately as a sign of a struggle. They don't believe the person who was with him. They naturally assume that she is a sex worker, that she was paid to have sex with him, that she there must have been some violent clash and she pushed him down the stairs. They also continually address her as male.
Yeah.
So that's these kind of microaggressions that keep happening throughout the film are very much present and very much in the kind of social commentary that's I think interwoven in it, coupled with these moments in which I think the wind scene really is a great expressionist moment of the kind of aggression and fight that she has to still carry on. You know, she's probably lived through about 10 years of acceptance and a journey of fighting for her own identity. And that just continues to continue.
Mm-hmm.
It's not going to end. And that wind that kind of suddenly erupts makes it so visually present.
Yes, absolutely. And it's kind of her idea of what's natural to her against, you know, what's conventionally seen as natural. So like the wind and these elements, if you like, of nature. There's this scene that I find very amusing. I think the mise-en-scène in it is spectacular. You just see Marina in her room alone, and there's this poster behind her on the wall with this high tide depicted, and you can see her sort of giving an air punch as if she's struggling with something, but there's nothing there. So obviously it's kind of, again, like that wind sequence showing how she has to battle against what people consider to be nature and, you know.
And there's these little moments of heightened emotion because she so very rarely is given her own voice to against all these forces. When you do get those moments, it's so enriching. Like when Aretha Franklin's Natural Woman plays, you initially think, oh, that's a bit on the nose, isn't it? But then you're totally into it and you think, this is totally deserved.
I loved that bit. Yeah, it was amazing.
That starts in the car wash, doesn't it? The song plays on the radio and then she goes into the cafe and it's playing.
I think it's when she's driving to Orlando's ex-wife to leave the car.
And she sees, the ghost. I mean, we mentioned it, but we haven't talked about it. The ghost appears repeatedly as this kind of, you know, lost entity.
Yes.
And there's something so interesting about what's going on in the representation of bodies in this film.
Mm.
And we can talk about Marina's body, but also Orlando's body is a great concern. He dies, his body's bruised, so there's this investigation, this mystery pending, only seen as a mystery from the point of view of the authorities, because we've seen what happened.
Mm.
So we completely believe the story and we know that's true. And then his body is completely removed from Marina. She's not allowed to go to the wake. She's not allowed to go to the funeral. She's not recognized as a member of his close family. And she keeps seeing him here and there. And then eventually it's when she actually gets to see the corpse, which is an incredibly moving scene. And she watches this body be sort of taken into the area where it's going to be cremated and disposed of. And it sort of made me think about how much the transition story is so much about the body and how, you know, our bodies reflect who we are. inside, and yet in the end the body is just this kind of container that gets disposed of. And what happens to the soul is the real question. So I found that a really beautiful moment, because I think she gets so much strength from actually seeing the conclusion of her lover's body's life, and she knows that she can take the rest of him with her. She doesn't have to continue to fight for this. So that was incredible.
It's always interesting that Orlando seems to appear at these key moments in the film. So as you said, he's kind of the one, his ghost rather, is the one who leads Marina to his body. But also it's when Orlando appears at this moment when Marina is in the car that she sort of takes off her glasses, where we see Orlando's reflection beautifully. And she sort of notices there's a key inside Orlando's car, and that key sort of becomes a driving force, if you like, for the rest of the film. And it's, as Lelio describes it, it's a MacGuffin. So it's this thing that gives the character a purpose throughout the film, but you don't really know where it's going to go and what it's going to lead to until much later.
Where it leads us,
yeah,
is an empty locker.
Yeah, so I think
in a sauna.
I think once I saw that sequence in the Finlandia sauna, I was just, that's when I knew I loved that film. It was the moment I fell in love with it. Like, you see this series of coincidences giving her clues as to what the key might unlock, and there's this man at the restaurant where she works that has a key just like hers. And she realizes, oh, it's the sauna. And, you know, you have this moment as the viewer where you're thinking, oh, my God, she's going to find the tickets. But do I want that to happen? Is that, you know, the ending that this film deserves?
Well, you mentioned Hitchcock as an influence on that. Like, this sequence of finding the keys and trying to unlock it and figuring out the mystery, it reads so much
like that. Absolutely, yes. It's sort of interesting how once she's in the sauna, there's this, again, this sort of climate of, oh, you know, is she, like, where do we see her? Is she supposed to be in the women's section? Is she supposed to be in the man's section? And we see her sort of transitioning from one to the other so that she can get to, you know, the gents and sort of have access to Orlando's locker. And that's a really interesting sequence for me. Like, the light just gives it this magical feeling of, you know, this is straight out of a dream. And then she opens the locker, and it's really interesting because there's no reflection for her to see there, as opposed to many other instances in the film. But it's that moment that's really defining for her. She sort of stares at this void, this empty locker, this black rectangle on the screen for us, which Lelio actually says is his personal homage to Kubrick and The Space Odyssey. So it's like the monolith to him, which again sort of just, you know, drives the character forward, like it's pulling them in.
Yeah. It's very Mulholland Drive, that moment as well.
Absolutely.
In Mulholland Drive, when they open the locker and the viewer is sucked into this void.
Yeah. Yes.
And somehow then you're back at some other point in the story. Yeah, I also love that scene. I thought it was in direct contrast with the scene in which she receives this totally invasive and horrifying physical inspection, where she is not made to be in control of her body, and she's asked a lot of questions. And throughout the film, there are all these questions that come in. Did you have the operation? Did you do this? Did you do that? And did you have sex? And how did it work, your relationship? And these questions are the most offensive thing that you can possibly think of, because they just reduce a person entirely to their body. And her body just becomes a site for everyone else's anxiety. What are you? The ex-wife says, when I look at you, I don't know what I'm seeing. You are, to me, a chimera.
A perversion.
A perversion. But the word chimera is really interesting. A chimera is a mythological creature who is a hybrid monster made from parts of other different creatures. So the offense is extraordinary, but so is the anxiety of the character who is saying this. Whereas throughout the film, I think it's very, very clear to us who we're looking at not what. We are looking at a person who has a very deep inner life, who has had probably a very intense journey to where she is. And we are completely with her. And I think that is the miracle of this film. So when we get to that point in the sauna where the situation could be as humiliating, she asks, is it separate? Meaning, is there a section for men and a section for women? And she's told yes. And it's at this point that she thinks, I can completely use this to my advantage. Mm. And I am the only person who can do this. And so there's just this kind of moment of owning herself and her body. And I think it's here that she really overcomes everything. And you think this woman can just tackle anything that comes her way. So it's very, very empowering. And I loved it. I was kind of whooping in my seat. And I was hoping that she would find the tickets. And then there's a film going. I thought, no, this is so much better. Because then what we get after that is even better than a trip to the Iguazu Falls.
Yes. Yeah, she sort of, after that dream sequence, she jumps back into reality. You know, like there isn't any hope for her in the sense that she's not going to escape reality, so she might as well face it. And that's what she does. That's when she decides, I don't care if they say I'm not allowed to the funeral, I'm going, it's my right, and Orlando was the person I loved. So she goes there, and it's then that Orlando's ghost sort of guides her to his body. And just before that, actually, you see this scene which I think is possibly the only Almodovar-like scene in the film, where she jumps on top of Orlando's ex-wife's car. and it's just a really funny but also very, just strong scene. She's basically standing her ground, and she stands on top of the car as if she's rising above both the man and the woman in that car, and she's just who she is.
She wants her dog back.
Yes.
Absolutely. I want to talk about the final scene, singing, which is a theme throughout the film. She's a singer. She performs a number of times. And we also see her going to a singing teacher.
Yes.
Who is clearly someone who's been around for a long time.
Another interesting person.
Yeah. Very interesting person. He's actually very compassionate, I think, and very loving. And he says to her, you're here to be a singer. You're here to get singing lessons. I'm not here to be your dad or your psychologist. And she kind of puts these words in his mouth as though she's heard it before. And I'm sure that she's, as anybody who uses kind of art to, you know, in an almost psychological way to help yourself through the difficulties of life, she's probably had these kind of pep talks from him before, and she's kind of making fun of him. But he's right. He just sees her as this singer. He says, come here, you're here to sing, I'll train you to sing. And sing she does, and beautifully at the end she sings this aria from Handel, I think.
Handel,
it is.
Yeah.
Which is an aria written specifically for a castrato. So the castrato in opera is the role played by a man whose testicles have been removed at a young age in order to develop a much higher tone voice. And the castratos were considered to be the finest singers around throughout the Baroque period, certainly when Handel was writing. So it's really, you know, the film is really saying we need to look at transgender people in a completely different way and value their experiences and value what they can bring that is not either man or woman. It's something else entirely, and it transcends our puny categories, and sort of somehow it's kind of two fingers up to everyone in the film who has asked her, what are you? What happened to your body?
And we see Marina asking this as well, don't we? A lot of the time, I feel like you can argue it's only a visual thing, but the convention of using mirrors in a film is just so, it's such a well-established thing that you're clearly making a statement when you do it. And when you do it repeatedly, like Lelio does, it's just, you know, so in your face. So you see Marina staring at a mirror right after she finds out Orlando's dead. She walks down the street and you see her reflections on the glass window of a building. But I think the three sort of places I really loved the use of mirrors was, well, for one thing, when she's sort of at this beauty parlor and she's doing her nails and she goes, oh my God, look at my hands, like these are orangutan fingers or something. And the sort of staff member there tells her, don't say that, that's a lie, don't talk about yourself that way. And then she walks out in the street and there are these workers carrying a mirror and it's all wobbly and it's not sturdy at all. And you're thinking, why would that scene be there if, you know, the use of mirrors is not intentional? And you sort of see other people putting a mirror in front of her and saying, you know, what we sort of see in ourselves is a lot of the time what others make us see. And another instance of the use of mirrors that's in contrast to this is when she's completely alone and she's kind of just holding this small mirror right in front of her genitalia. And we don't know what's down there because we haven't been told anything explicitly even after the inspection scene. But she's alone and that's a key moment for her. She's just looking down there. She sees her reflection. We don't know what's there, but it's only her that can define what she is, what her sexual identity is, what her identity overall is.
She sees her face in the mirror. So it's an incredible shot.
This is it. This beautiful. Is absolutely, you almost want to just pause it and stand up and applaud for this moment because it is such a simple but astonishing image. And you wonder, how have you never seen something like this before? Like these reflections are something that you highlight in the blog piece that you've written, so I encourage everyone to check that out for a bit more information on that.
It will be on the Curzon blog soon as well, so in an expanded version. So you can read it there. I wanted to talk briefly about another reflection moment, which is just after we have the most sort of explicit attack on Marina, which is she gets abducted basically by Orlando's violent, awful, vile son and other members of the family, and they wrap her face with sellotape, and I found that just so incredibly awful. I was so worried about her throughout that scene because it can get to such horrible places, and they just completely deface her with a sellotape, transparent sellotape on her face, and then they leave her.
I think that was one of the most shocking moments.
Yeah,
for me
it really was, and it's. I'm sure any film goer watches things that are much more explicitly violent, much more, you know, gory. But the aggression of this and the violation is so incredibly awful. And
the intention they have. Yeah.
Makes me think of, as you said, about the wobbly mirror.
Yes.
Like highlighting this distorted reflection back to her. As you say, it's the transparent sellotape. So underneath it all, we can still see that it's her face.
Yeah.
And it's how these other people have chosen to distort it to reflect their view of her.
But also very beautifully, she gets ditched in this alleyway and there's a parked vehicle there and she sort of stands beside it and she's taking the sellotape off. And we see this reflection of, you know, a disfigured Marina. And it's essentially the monster that these people see in her. And it's such a beautiful shot because, you know, she probably questions herself at that point. Am I this monster that others see in me?
And do you know what that reminded me of very, very strongly was a moment in Mary Shelley's Frankenstein in which the creature who is this, you know, human-generated person who has consciousness and has depth and has a richness and a desire for knowledge and a desire to develop feelings, but gets completely abandoned and is looked at by society as this creature composed of bodily parts that came from other creatures. So a chimera, as we've heard. And he looks at himself. There's a reflection on the water and he sees his face and he understands why people run away from him. But then at that point, there is this kind of complete moment of consciousness of thinking, you know, who am I? Yes. What do people see when they look at me? And how can I become
what I am?
What I am. Yeah. So it's really another moment in which this line between, you know, how people see her and how eventually she will see herself and will continue to fight for herself and her identity is completely encapsulated by the visuals.
And on that note, we are going to have to wrap up this conversation. Exactly. I dare say it's been fantastic. thank you so much for being here, Diego. And thank you, Irina, for coming back to us again. Now, this is not the only film out this week, A Fantastic Woman. If you can't make it to the cinema, actually, you can watch it online or on demand with Curzon Home Cinema, where it is available. And from Monday, from the 5th, you can also catch Yorgos Lanthimos' Killing of a Sacred Deer and Sean Baker's The Florida Project, who we talked about. And he was the director of Tangerine, which I think is on the service as well. So do go and check those out from Monday. If you do have any thoughts on A Fantastic Woman, then do let us know by emailing podcast@curzon.com. And if you are new to the podcast, do go back and listen to our back catalogue. We've got loads of great episodes. We've got a recent Q&A with all the team from Call Me By Your Name, with Luca Guadagnino, and I got it.
Yes.
Amazing.
Thank you. And Armie Hammer and Timothy Chalamet. That's a really great Q&A. It's hosted by Robbie Collin. So do go back and listen to that, as well as the recent episode with Greta Gerwig for Lady Bird. And until next time, make sure you subscribe, leave us a review and comment on iTunes. And we'll see you next time. It's goodbye from me. It's goodbye from Diego.
Goodbye.
And it's goodbye.
It's been a pleasure.
It's been a pleasure having you. And it's goodbye from Irina.
Goodbye.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.